Good afternoon. Good evening. I appreciate everybody's patience. You want to hear the excuses now or later? Thank you very much for your patience. I do send you greetings or bring you greetings from Eagle Rock. And boy, did we have a drive down here. I come down here quite often on business. And so I know the road very, very well. We stopped five times, and I was telling two of the elders that were kind enough to greet me, I got to see a $100,000 bright yellow Corvette scattered over three lanes of the freeway in Temecula, and it was pretty bad. But anyway, it is a pleasure to be here with you. I wanted to bring you a message that I hope you'll enjoy. I'm going to use a little electronics here. I find the paper sometimes is hard to read, and as we get older, the eyesight begins to dim, and we'll be out of here by about 5:30, I figure. I got to make it up to you, don't I? When my children were in high school, it was interesting because they're required, as you know, to take certain classes. And one of those classes that they had to take was chemistry. Now, how many of you, when you took chemistry in high school, maybe college, were so thankful that you had the opportunity to take this wonderful subject? I don't see any hands. Okay, there are liars in the group. Okay, great. Chemistry is my background, and I always, you know, introduce you to who you are. You say, well, I was a chemist. And what do you think the first thing out of their mouth is after I tell them what I did? Of all the subjects that I took in high school and college, I hated chemistry. Well, my children had to take it. They had to take a science, and they took that. Because their father was a chemist, they were cursed twice. But we had a problem in all three cases. Our kids are fairly intelligent. They got good grades in high school, but they struggled in chemistry and all the associated attendant math with it. So I went to an open house, and I work with teachers. I think teachers are a gifted group of people. I know that we have a few here. But some of them have a regular job for 30, 40 years, and then they say they can do what? Teach. Well, I went to open house, and I met the chemistry teacher when my oldest son started. This wonderful man had spent 40 years in the Air Force and all of a sudden decided he needed to get a teaching credential in chemistry. He could teach chemistry about as well as the bottom of my shoe. He couldn't teach anything if it was given $1 million. So I came back, and I said, Jonathan, you're right. This teacher's got a problem. But guess what? You're cursed three times. You're going to learn chemistry, and I'm going to be your teacher. And it was interesting to work with the kids, and when you help them with homework, you have to be very kind and patient, both of which do not come easily for me. But one of the things that we went through in the math and the chemistry is there are formulas. There are numbers. And in most things in life, you have to have steps. And they constantly would skip the steps. And if my children were here today and I used that phrase, skip steps, you'd see them wince. They're damaged for the rest of their lives from those two words. Because they get the answer wrong because they skip steps. Today what I'd like to discuss with you is the chemical perspective of a very interesting section of our New Testament, which I think is probably a number one issue in all the churches of God. It's Matthew 18. And I've entitled it, The Chemistry of Matthew 18. I'll guarantee you've never heard a title like that, because we're going to take a little bit different perspective to it. Matthew 18, when we think of it, we always think of the issue of going to your brother. You go to your brother. In verse 15, going to your brother. But we're not going to start there, because if we start in Matthew 18, we miss the point at verse 15. We're going to divide this chapter into four sections, and obviously if you would turn with me to Matthew 18, we will spend all of our time, 100%, we're going to clearly see that there is a definition in each of the sections that separate the sections one from another. But as much as they're separated, they're very, very, very close together in meaning. Jesus will use some very interesting terms here, and he'll use what I call key examples. He will use three different themes. He'll use two that are animate and one that is inanimate. In other words, two that are living, one that is not. I'm going to ask you to spy those out as we read along. Because you're all going to be chemists today. We're all going to analyze. We're all going to look at things the way we've never looked at them before. We're going to look at this like we've never looked at it in the past. You're going to look at the references that he makes to the kingdom of heaven and heaven. And I'd also like you to always look at the personal pronouns that are used in this section because they are the key to it. It starts off in chapter 18, verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Why did they ask this question? There's a good reason they asked that question. They had to know. They had to know who was the greatest because they knew it had to be one of them. That's why. It had to be one of them. It had to be them. They're the apostles. They're the called ones of God. Got to be them. So who was the greatest? I always beat up on the apostles. Someone told me up in Eagle Rock, they said, "You got to lay off the apostles." I said, "The Bible doesn't lay off the apostles. I'm not laying off the apostles." So then Jesus called him a little child and set him in the midst of them. Because he has now caused a contrast, and this is the first animate object that he uses as an example. He takes a child, a little child. There are children who are big children. We call them big children. Then there are children who are little. We call them little. The word in the Greek is interesting. It's where we get the word microscope. It's the word mikros. Mikros, meaning micro or small. We don't know how small he was, or if it was a he. He set the word him there is in the masculine Greek, but it doesn't necessarily need to be. He set the child in the midst of them and said, "Assuredly, for sure, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will be by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." There's that phrase again. "Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." There it is again. "Whoever receives one little child like this little child in my name receives me." So we see this tremendous contrast. He says, who is the greatest in the kingdom of God? He says, people who act like children. Not just any kind of child. A humble child. A humble little child. All of us, when we think of children, and a lot of us, most of us have had children, all of us have been children, everyone in this room, and we know that many children can be very, very selfish. That's not the kind Jesus is talking about. He's talking about that image that we have in our mind's eye of someone who is small, who is probably fairly weak. They probably walk, but not well. But they're a humble little child, and that's what he says to them. Humble means to reduce or to abase or to lower, by extension, oneself. It's when you are humble, you don't exalt yourself, you abase yourself. You become lower. So this child is a child by its own nature, is someone who is an individual who has not exalted themselves. And I want you to remember this example because we're going to see this example. It is pivotal to the rest of this chapter. To lose the fundamental aspects of Matthew 18 and all that it means and not include verses 4 and 5 are to miss all of 18. So we see this, and it continues in verse 6. It's still in the first section. Whoever causes one of these little ones. Now we can extrapolate not only from an actual little child, but we know what he's talking about. He's talking about the little ones that believe in him. Little ones, young ones in the faith who believe in me, they cause them to sin. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses. For offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. What do you call a person who causes offenses? There's a special word for him. It comes from the word offense. It's real simple. He's called the offender. Offense, offender. He's called the one who offends. He's the offender. I want you to remember that word. So woe to the offender. Verse 8, if your hand or your foot cause you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame and maimed, or maimed rather than having two hands, 2 feet, to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire. Now, we can take this in two different ways when it talks about the offending party. Many people interpret chapter 18 in Matthew as having to do with church administration. Now, I have not mentioned the word church. The Bible has not mentioned the word church, the word ecclesia, not once. Hasn't mentioned that lofty and august and extremely important title, elder, either. It's not there. We haven't read it, have we? Have we? I haven't read it. So therefore, the word is missing. So guess who it's talking about? Right? It's talking about an individual. It's talking about an individual who causes offenses. And if your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you, the personal pronoun is you in the singular, to enter into the into life, that's eternal life, lame or maimed. Lame or maimed. We understand why this is used as we get deeper into chapter 18 of Matthew. It continues with the thought, it is better, end of 9, it is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire, rather than what? Rather than offend one of these little ones. One would get the impression, one would get the logical conclusion that God is very, very concerned about little ones, wouldn't it? Wouldn't we say that after the last 9 verses, he said, be humble as a child, be like a little child, and don't anybody offend them. Don't offend these people. Go out of your way not to offend. And if you have offended them, you'll be labeled as an offender. And if you're labeled an offender, you better do something about it to correct it. He continues. It gets worse. Because as we look at this, we're looking about the issue so far in chapter 18 of one overarching principle. It is our treatment of one another, isn't it? Isn't that what we're talking about? Is our treatment one to another. I was given permission to discuss it's called a principle of understanding. That was expressed at the Council of Elders retreat. Right? I was like, you all know that the Council of Elders, the 12 elders that were what are they, guys? Are they balloted or elected? Chosen by God. Right? No, and we know a lot of them, one in particular, and we love them to death. Isn't it interesting they went on a retreat? You know, in military terms, when you go on a retreat, you're running away from something. Ask Mr. Weber what he was retreating from. On their retreat, they discussed this principle of understanding of how the Church of God has not always handled relationships properly. Now, I know you don't have any idea of what I'm referring to. No one in your personal experience would lead you to believe that there's been issues one to another. However, they did discuss this. And they discussed the simple scripture of Matthew 18 as a God-given cure to his people. They discussed Matthew chapter 18, verses 15, 16, and 17. I will prove to you today it is the entire chapter that must be studied. The underlying theme throughout Matthew 18 is one of forgiveness. It is one of reconciliation. It is one of mano y mano. There is no collectivity here, as we'll see. It is all individuals, and that's where it begins and that's where it ends. But as I said, he goes on. He goes to the parable of the lost sheep. And all of these we've heard of. These are so important, such important verses. You know, the childlike attitude. You know, suffer the children, let them come unto me. Who causes one of these little? It's better to walk through life with one leg than to offend these children. The next one, he says, take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you that in heaven, there's that word again, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. Again, this idea of reconciliation. He says, take heed you do not despise one of them. How could you despise a humble little child? How could you despise them? We'll see why. It has to do with offenses. He then moves on to the same section. Strangely enough, he says, verse 12, what do you think? What do you think? What could you be thinking of? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountains to seek the one that is straying? It's another parable that we know so very, very well. the parable of the 90 and 9. It's still within the context of the little ones, as we'll see. If he has 100 sheep, one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountain to seek the one that is gone? And if he should find it, assuredly I say to you, he rejoices over that one sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. The little ones who are so easily offended, God, Jesus says, is so important to him. Let me ask you a question. Who's the shepherd here? Now, you could take two different positions. We can take the collective position that the shepherd is the church, and the church should go after those that are lost. And that would be a noble principle, wouldn't it? We would all agree with that. That'd be a good thing to do. However, we know who is the good shepherd. Audible response is fine. Who's the good shepherd? Christ, who is always pictured as the shepherd in the Bible. Not some of the time, not part of the time, not most of the time. Every time. It's just right. Very correct. It is Jesus who is the good shepherd. It is Jesus who goes after the offended party. Now, let me ask you, since we're talking about people and we're talking about offenses, would you like to be an offender? No. You would not like to be an offender. Would you like to be the offender who caused one of the little ones to go astray and that Jesus was called upon to bring him back? Would you then want to be the offender? No. No. You wouldn't want to be the offender for those two reasons. One, he says, don't do it. Number two, he has to go out and find them and bring them back. However, we can say that not only does Jesus is the arch example, we as elders and you as members should emulate that. We don't want to lose one, do we? Somebody asked me just recently, back last night we had some people over, they asked, do you still do a head count at Passover? Technically, yeah, we do. But we also, I know the elders do here, because I know them, they all get together with your pastor and they go over who was here, because they care. They go over who was not here, because they care. They also, who was here that they didn't know? Who were those people? Right? Because they care. It's important that the church emulates these very important ideas of God, Jesus as God's good shepherd. We now move into the second section. But keep in mind, we have been talking for 14 verses in Matthew 18 about the issue of little ones who show humility, who can become offended. And we move right into that, into the probably one of the most argued and divisive sections over reconciliation, I think, the church has. Most churches do. Verse 15, the word moreover, it is added in the original. However, it's an important word. Moreover, or all the more, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Assuredly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you that if two or three agree on earth concerning anything that you ask, that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them. All these verses are so well known. None of these are obscure verses. I mean, they're all packed together in Matthew 18. All the more reason we shouldn't be separating them. But let's look at Matthew 18:15. I want you to know the cause, what we call causal attributes of the section. It's the word if, the ian in Greek. If your brother sins against you, if he hears you, if he will not hear you, if he refuses to listen to them, if he refuses even to hear the church. These are all conditional or causal issues. They're saying, if these things happen, then this might happen. And if this happens, then this happens. It is a series of three short steps. Now, back to steps. Now we get into the analytical chemistry. I think you'll enjoy this. I'm a chemist. I enjoy it. Therefore, you're all chemists, we said today, so you will enjoy it. First, number one, you what? Go to your brother. Step one, right? If he has offended you. Now, the against you is interesting. It's in the text of the New King James. It is not in some of the other translations. So it says, moreover, if your brother sins, the against you is not present in all manuscripts, but it's still important. What you should do, you go to him. You tell him his fault between you and him and a very large group of people so that many, many brethren can overhear. Right? It's kind of what we do, isn't it? I got to go tell about what Larry did. Sorry. And I probably tell that to 6, 7, 8 people. But I'm going to go to him alone after I've told 6 or 7 people. So number one, you go to your brother. Second, if he won't hear you, you bring the people that have you've already talked to, right? And you use them as witnesses because you've already what? What's it called to the jury pool? Contaminated the jury pool, and you bring them along. That's the second step. And if you won't hear them, you've got a big problem. Now we got to deal with it. But this is not really three steps. There are preparatory steps. And in chemistry, before you conduct a trial or an experiment or you're doing a chemical process of any kind, but do we have any chemists in the room? Any of those that are the holy and righteous of the physical sciences? None. Well, okay, you all hated chemistry. Now I get the picture. When you conduct these experiments or when you have production, you must have, it's kind of a joke inside the industry, it says your glassware must be clean. Got to have clean glassware. You got to have clean pots. You got to have clean vessels. You have to have ultra clean. Now, I'm so old, I remember cleaning with hot soap and unbelievably acidic soaps, or excuse me, alkali soaps, and it would almost etch the glass. We had to clean and we had to clean, and then we got an autoclave and we were able to clean them in an autoclave, which is superheated steam. So you have to have clean glassware, your utensils. Your materials that you use must be of the highest quality, and there's certain standards that must be used. You have to have 99.9% pure, and you have to even know what the impurities are. It will hurt your experiment. It will hurt your production, especially in pharmacology. They have to be ultra pure, and sometimes we sell Six Sigma or we say 6/9% pure, 99.9999%. So your chemicals, your materials have to be of the purest quality, and the standards that you use to test your materials, they must be exact. It's kind of like in chemistry, you have chemicals that are standards by which you measure others. It's kind of like a ruler. If you have a ruler, a foot ruler, and it's only 11.9 inches, that's not a ruler. So your standards have to be exact. And these are the things that you do before you can do anything in chemistry. And we always have this little battle after 30 years of marriage. When I go into the kitchen and there's glasses or dinnerware that need to be washed, and my kids made it hurts, and they said, Dad, you didn't clean any of that glassware you used. And I turned around and I said, I will have cleaned more glassware in my lifetime than you will in 5 lifetimes. Glassware must be clean. Chemistry goes overboard, and people can get hurt when you don't do what you're supposed to do preparatory, right? Or preparatorily. People can get hurt. In fact, I have, unfortunately, a few scars on my hand where the gloves weren't quite right, or I wasn't watching exactly what I was doing, and they're going to be there forever. Different acids. And I've got one, I'll show it to you later. I've got one that's nitric acid, and the one over here is sulfuric acid, and I'm not even sure what that one is. I don't know. So, but you have to be careful. And if you're not careful, people get hurt. They get deeply hurt. They could lose their life. And I've seen some explosions and some problems occur in labs where people have lost eyesight. Some have died. Not my experience, but we've heard of them. So we can't skip the steps in chemistry. You can never, ever skip the steps. They have to be done in order. You can't clean the glassware before you conduct the after you conduct the experiment. You can't make sure your materials are proper after the experiment. It's too late. In fact, the experiment, the process you're conducting is worthless. It's useless. It's tainted. So when my children were studying, I explained to them, the book is trying to explain you the steps to take. Step one, step two, step three. Why are you starting with step two? I know you're in a hurry. Why do you start with step two? And then go to step one. And then remember step three. And then wonder why we don't have the right answer. Right? Brethren, why do we skip step one? Why do we do that? We do that. What's interesting is we become offended. Who's the offended party in Jesus' examples here? Remember, let's read it again. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, you haven't done anything. You've had it done to you. Who's the offended party? You are, in this example. Who offended you? The offender. Now, Jesus has just spent 14 verses explaining who the offended party is. Who's the offended party here? The child. Right? The child. Isn't that the offended party? We take verses 1 through 14 away and then jump to verse 15. Because verses 1 through 14 describe in tremendous detail about who sins against whom. Now, that's what I think is interesting. We are offended. Let's just say we're offended. And you have a right to be offended. Something horrible, egregiously has happened to you. It's all happened to every one of us. It's happened to me. I'm a nice guy. Why would anybody want to offend me? But they have. I'm offended. And I demand, what do I demand? Retribution. That's right. That's a biblical phrase. I demand retribution. So what do? When I'm offended, do I go to the offender? Absolutely not. I go to the minister, don't I? By show of hands of the elders, how many of you have had people come? No, I'm kidding. I'll give you my example. All the elders have had people come to them in the best of intentions and said, so-and-so has offended me. You know what I say to that person when they come to me? You're not going to like me after this. I ask them, let's say that Becky offended me. I got to ride home in the car with her for an hour and a half, but that's okay. Becky has offended me, right? She has offended me. I ask this person, what did Becky say when you went to her? What? Now, the elders in particular are laughing. What did they say to you when you went to them? I'm not going to them. They're not going to listen. I'm coming to you. It's Matthew 18. I'm going to you. I'm offended and I expect you to do something about it. Isn't that true? We want to go just like when we're offended at In-N-Out. Get me the manager. I want the manager. Here, I asked for onions twice. There's no onions in this hamburger. I want the manager. Now you laugh. You laugh. What we do at In-N-Out, what we do at Target, we sometimes do at church. We ask for the manager. The problem is the minister is not the manager. The minister is another brethren. This is what it says. Step one says, go to your brother, you, the offended party, to the offended. But humble people, let me ask you, humble people, are they offended? They're not humble if they're offended. Right? It's hard to offend a humble person. Yeah? How many of you ever met a truly humble person? Nobody in this room? That's part of the problem. I know you have. I know you have. You've met this person. It is very difficult to get them upset. It's very difficult to offend them. They have a very, very good perspective. But who is the offender here? It's the other person. So the offended party is going to the offender. The humble person is going to the offender. Do you know how rare that is? Humble people don't go to the offender. What do they do? What's the word that they do? What do they do? They're courteous. They're what? I heard forgive. They forgive. They forgive. Isn't that interesting? The steps go back to verses 4 through 6. It says, therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one of these, one little child like this in my name receives me. Verse 6, whoever causes one of these little ones who believes in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and dumped in the bay, the depths of the sea. Woe to the person who causes offense. And these two people, the offender and the babe who is offended, right, to whom the offender, offendee, who's in trouble here? Who's in tremendous trouble? The offender. The offender's in trouble. I think Matthew 18, verse 15, 16, and 17 are for such unbelievably dire circumstances. But they're there nonetheless. It's very interesting. The key word is the offended party. It is the offender who is in grave trouble. Right? Because if it's the offense is so egregious for this little lamb, which was the second inanimate object, if the lamb is so offended, he is driven from the congregation or the assembly, that Jesus has to go and get him. Right? It is greatly, greatly a serious situation. The steps of Matthew 18:15 do not start at 18:15. They start at the beginning with a humble heart by the offended party. Offenses will come. We've all been offended in this room, probably repeatedly. Probably repeatedly by the same individual or the same group of individuals. Offenses will come. Jesus said they will come. But woe to the person who causes the offense. He is hoping, I guess, by extension, that the person who is offended will forgive that person. It's a great thing. We go on, and he says in verse 21, then Peter came to him. Good old Peter. So sensitive at this point in Jesus' ministry. So understanding. He says, then Peter came to Jesus and said, Lord, how often do I have to forgive these people? Up to seven times? Seven times? Now, the seven times is interesting because in rabbinic law, those of you that want to look it up in your Mishnah, it's Yoma chapter 86, section 2. It says that all that was required of the law, saith the rabbi, the elders at the time, the council at the time, was three times. Three times. Forgive them once because they didn't know. Forgive them twice because they didn't understand. Forgive them the third time. I'm not even sure what it said on the third time. The third times was enough. After that, guess what you did? In rabbinic law, after the third forgiveness, you were to grab a witness and speak to that individual. It is directly from Matthew 18, chapter 15. You are to grab a witness, two witnesses. For in the mouths of two or three witnesses, you and one other person, or you and two other people, you will have the issue settled, or you should have. But it is still interesting, three times. Up to seven times, you know, double, above the law, rabbinic law. Jesus said to him, it's only two short verses. Should I forgive him seven times? Jesus said, verse 22, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. Now, those of us that count sin love this verse. Those of us that love to count how many times we've been ticked off, messed around, right? Offended, right? I'm probably 7 times 70, it's 490. I'm probably in the high 300s. No, I'm not. I think, obviously, we know what Jesus is saying here. He is saying, don't count them. Don't count them. It isn't important. You should forgive them every time, all the time. What if they haven't repented? Not your problem, is it? It's not your problem. It is a wonderful thing to forgive, as we'll see in the very last section, the fourth section. It's interesting that how many times do I forgive someone? 70 times 7. The third section is only two simple verses. But there's not been a section up until this last one that isn't very well known to everyone who reads their Bible. The last section is an interesting one because it has to do, Jesus moves right into, how many times should I forgive someone? He uses a numerical value. 70 times 7, you know, the perfect sevens. But then he goes on into the fourth section, and he teaches from a parable, a very standard parable. He tells a story. He says, therefore, verse 23, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. So we have an accounting issue. We have a monetary issue, which is our third symbol. Two were animate children, humble children. Two were sheep. And number three, inanimate, is money. Money. Settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now, various commentators will tell you this was an incredible amount of money. By some cases, it's $5 billion worth of money. In other cases, it's, 15, 20 years of wages. It is an astronomical amount of money. What is interesting, 10,000 talents was an unheard of amount of money. It wasn't used. One commentator said, and this was 20 years ago, he said, it would be like saying $5 billion, right? Well, that was 20 years ago. $5 billion we won't go there, right? It would be saying like $50 gigatrillion. So let's use that because this is the year 2009 and 1, 2, 3, and 4 trillion mean nothing to us, right? So when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10 gigatrillion dollars. Oy! Right? Verse 20, whoa. So what did this guy do? And whose administration was he a part of to have built up that kind of debt? Verse 25, but he was not able to pay. No kidding. Yeah, right? Who said the Bible doesn't have any humor? But he was not able to pay. His master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. Great. So this guy's not worth 10 gigatrillion dollars. The servant therefore fell down before him. Master, have patience with me, and I'll pay you all. I'll pay you everything. 10 gigatrillion. Now, let's look at the logic of this. Right? Here's the kingdom of heaven. There's a king. The man comes before him. He says, you owe me 10 gigatrillion dollars. Pay me. I haven't got it. I can't pay it. He's not able to pay. He was not able to pay. What does that mean? He didn't have it. Right? So he finds out he's going to be sold basically into slavery, along with his family. The guy turns around and says, have patience on me, and I'll pay you all. Patience? How many lifetimes is this going to take? Patience? This is a ridiculous remark, isn't it? It's an absurd remark. He can't pay it. And the king knows that. He says, have patience, and I'll pay you everything. Then the master of the servant was moved with what? Compassion. He released him. And he uses the word, he forgave him the debt. He forgave him the debt. Now, if you owe 10 gigatrillion dollars, would you be happy? You'd be happy. You'd be uproariously, riotously happy. I would. Verse 28. But that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. About a day's wage. You see the contrast that Jesus uses? He is full of contrast. It's called a maximus a minimus. It means from the greater extreme to the lesser extreme. Jesus is famous for this. He uses these, we would say, crazy numbers because they're in such contrast to each other that even a simple person would figure this out. So the person that's just been forgiven $10 gigatrillion finds a fellow servant who owes him 100 denarii. Right? Remember, there was talents versus denarii. He laid hands on him. He took him by the throat and said, pay me what you owe. Right? See the contrast? Here's the king in the throne room. The servant that owes this money, maybe with his family, comes and says, I can't pay you. All right, I forgive you. I forgive you. He turns around. He went out. The word is the emphatic in the original. It says that almost immediately he went out and found somebody else, laid hands on him, starts to choke him. Pay me what you owe. So his fellow servant fell down, right? Fell down. Notice, who else fell down? Verse 26, the servant therefore fell down. Fast forward, verse 29, so his fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him. And begged him, saying, have patience with me and I'll pay you all. Now see, where did we hear this? Let's think for a minute. Where else did we hear this? Oh yeah, let's back up. Where did the guy that was forgiven the $10 gigatrillion hear this? Where did he hear it? He says, that sounds familiar. Who said that? Oh, I did. Whatever. It didn't slow him down one bit. Patience, Smithy, I'll pay you all. And he would not, but went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. I guess these people think that somehow going into prison you'd be able to pay debt. Did you hear that they raised the California state prisons up to $3, what is it, a month? Right? Or a week or whatever? Verse 31, so when his fellow servants saw that had been done, they were grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, you wicked servant. I forgave you all that debt, that astronomical amount of money, because you begged me. You begged me. Should you not also have had compassion on your fellow servant just as I had pity on you? Who's the offender here? Who's the offender and who's the offended? It hasn't changed. His master was angry. I think the King James doesn't say wroth. His master was wroth with him and delivered him to the torturers. We're beyond prison. We're beyond slavery. We're into the torturers until he should pay all that was due. I have a trouble figuring out how you're going to be sold to pay for 10 gigatrillion. How you're going to have to pay 100 denarii in prison. I have no idea how you're going to pay for it if you're being tortured. There's irony here. You can't. You can't pay it. You're done. You're done. Until he should pay all that was due him. It's interesting, the punishment here may mean much more than just a simple accounting measure. If you were to put this in its spiritual context, which is really what its intent is, because it isn't about accounting, how would you typify that kind of punishment? To have been forgiven much and not to have been forgiven and not to forgive others. What would that do to someone whose mind God is working with? It'd be greater than prison. It'd be greater than sold. I would hope you'd be tortured mentally. That it would weigh on you. Because if it didn't, you've got a far greater problem. Jesus ends the entire section with verse 35. So, my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses. It has nothing to do with accounting. It doesn't have anything to do with money. But there is a word in accounting called reconciling the books. Balancing the books. The books have to balance. It's basically of justice. Of forgiveness. Jesus is saying he who has been forgiven of incredible sins has absolutely, positively no reason to ever not forgive another. It's that simple. It has to do with forgiveness. to whom much is forgiven, much is expected. God does not say we have to forget the sin. That's almost impossible in the human mind. I do remember the people who have tried to hurt me. You do too. But there is a difference between remembering it, which is impossible to remove from your mind. I don't think any human being can, especially in deep, deep hurts. But Jesus says here, by example in this parable, forgiveness is mandatory. Why? Because we have been forgiven. Jesus is saying, we have who much is forgiven, much is expected. So when we think of, indeed, this chapter of 18, we think of it in different terms. We should not focus on chapter 18, verse 15, when we're offended. Well, I need to go to that person. I'm going to have a problem doing that. And if he's not going to listen, I know he's not going to listen to me. He's not. He's just defiant. He's not going to listen. I'm probably going to have to bring a couple people and as witnesses who hopefully don't know about this. And boy, that's not going to work either. So we're just going to wind up going to the church. That's what we're going to wind up doing, I guess. No, there's not three steps. There's one. It says, go back to verse 2 if you would with me. Chapter 2, verse 2, chapter 18. Jesus called a little child to him, set him in the midst of him, and said, unless you are converted to become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom. Therefore, humble yourself as this little child, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And then we move to the last verse, verse 35 again. So my heavenly Father also will do to each of us from his heart if he does not forgive his brother his trespasses. That's the little child. They're talking about the same person, aren't they? Verse 35 is still talking about the little child. He says the little children, those that are truly humble and according to God's word, they will forgive. Because the humble child knows that he has been forgiven, doesn't he? A humble child of God. Therefore, we read all of it in verse 4 and verse 35. Matthew 18 says, be humble and forgive.